Hey, thanks for dropping by. Come on in.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
No one writes letters anymore. Just doesn't happen. And that is what makes a couple of my guests in the drawing room really remarkable, in that not only have they forced people to write letters somehow, and all sorts of people from all over the world, it's really incredible who they can convince to do this, but that they've managed to turn it into quite a money spinner, not for themselves, but for a charity. In fact, I would say they are currently the world's ambassadors for letter writing at the moment. And every now and again, they're just so overflowing with letters that wonderful, charming, and occasionally disgusting people write that they can turn them into books. And they've done it again. I don't even know how many books they're up to now. Michaela Maguire and Marieke Hardy are my guests. They are in charge of a thing that's often called Women of Letters, but it extends to men occasionally. They have a new book out called Between Us, and here they are to tell us about it. Thanks for coming in.
No worries.
Hi.
Have you, either of you, written a letter in the past 10 years?
Yes, of course.
Really?
I mean, we're beholden to it now. It's one of those things that's
very
like
awkward when you do radio interviews and we say, no, actually, we don't like letters very much.
It's like that celebrity chef guy and his activated almonds. If you ever saw him, you know, chowing down at a fast food outlet, you'd be like, look at him, he's a fraud.
So I gather you don't have email? You don't use social media?
No, I do it all by carrier pigeon and, you know, the legit, but, you know, cruelty-free carrier pigeon.
Yeah.
I was a voracious letter writer in my early 20s. I wrote to politicians. I wrote fan letters to Bill Bryson and David Sedaris, who both wrote back.
Wow.
Yeah. I keep them in a folder. You know, I would write fan letters. I'd write positive letters about products that I like because I thought everyone gets too many complaint letters and it's nice to tell people. I know. I'm surprisingly kind.
Really?
I know. It is surprising. Surprising. That sort of dropped off, and then, you know, I got into emails like everybody else. And then I think with doing Women of Letters, which we've now been doing for 5 years, we started it in March 2010 in Melbourne. And you do see, A, the romanticism and intimacy of a letter in the spoken pieces, but also because we scatter the room with aerograms and postcards and invite the audiences to write pieces of their own. I write letters at shows or postcards, really. I'm usually too busy to write a letter, but it has inspired me to get a few more pen pals.
The other great irony about the Women of Letters is that organising 39 shows around Australia and the world every year means that Marieke and I email each other about 39 times every single day.
So you don't even have time to write letters.
Makes us appreciate it a lot more. And I think now when we get emails, it's, oh God, not another one. But receiving and writing letters is
there's something special about the letter.
Lally Katz, the playwright, she's Women of Letters alumni. She and I went through a period when after we met and we took to each other quite rapidly and we went, let's only arrange dates by letter. And so we would send each other something in the post saying, do you want to meet in Lygon Street for a cup of tea?
So and then 3 weeks later you get a reply saying no.
Yeah, we'd have to plan quite far ahead.
So how many times a year would you see her then?
About, you know, 3 or 4 because we both travel a lot and it's one of those when you're in the same town.
Well,
but, you know, that's so the great thing about Lally. You know, she writes how she talks. So she's got this big scrawling penmanship and just all over the envelope and, you know. And I think that was quite a romantic thing to do.
So there are two phases at which we've lost the letter. One is where we started typing them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second phase is the email phase where we just stopped doing them. We stopped even typing them. So the people that you're getting to do letters, do you ever force them to write?
No, we don't. But it's funny, actually, when we travel the shows more frequently, we did a show in Wellington the other week, and I think 5 out of the 6 women who did it had handwritten their letters, and you might only get one person per Melbourne show who does that. Like, people read them off their iPads at our shows. One woman in Wellington did even, like, she didn't put it in an envelope.
She did. She opened it on stage quite theatrically. It was fantastic.
Which is really quite amazing. I think David Williamson did that as well.
Because I think you write very differently if you write it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to quote someone who is also alumni, Max Walker.
Yeah.
Who I know was alumni because I was at the one that he, he did.
Yeah.
I remember him once upon a time talking about when he wrote books, he would write them longhand because he said you write differently, you think totally differently about the sentence you are about to write when you are about to commit it to paper via ink.
I think that's a generational thing as well. I mean, I'm in this kind of weird, I'm used to writing by hand at school. I did a lot of things by hand at school. We didn't have computers at school. We had one computer class. And now I'm kind of, you know, on the internet all the time. It is hard when you pick up a letter or something, and you see your handwriting, which you don't often see, even your shopping list you do on your phone often now, and how it cramps your hand and you think, oh, gosh, I don't know how to write things by hand anymore. It's so painful and so awkward. I can't imagine doing a whole book. It's hard enough to write a whole letter now.
But
do
you write differently, you reckon?
I do. I think I've been writing and on computers for about 20 years, and I type really fast, and I probably type as fast as my brain goes, but my handwriting is slower than my brain, and when it tries to keep up, it's completely like a doctor's handwriting. It's illegible. Yeah, I think I do, and I like not really checking it back as well, and that's what I like about letters as well. I don't go back and look at my sent folder, because you can't get into an Australia Post box, because that's illegal.
That's true.
You just have to put it in there and hope for the best and be patient. That's the other thing I really like about it. And you think about kids that were away at boarding school during the war or away from their families or in rural communities and waiting months and months and months to get a letter that said, oh, by the way, your brother passed away.
I know.
2 months ago. But even just the anticipation, waiting for someone you love, waiting for something to arrive or waiting for someone to get something. If you've sent a significant letter, it's not that you press enter and you think, well, they must have read it now because I know they're on their phone. Or I've got a red, those little scene. Oh, that's so hurtful. Scene, 8:43 p.m. I like that you send it off and then you just got to sit with it for a while. There's something lovely about that.
Yeah, the scene thing is scary, isn't it?
It's dreadful.
And the panic of no reply starts really immediately these days.
I don't open the message until I can answer it.
Yeah, if I'm out and I know that I'm going to be not at a computer for a few hours, I won't open them because I don't want people to think that I'm ignoring them.
But the problem is you can open them by accident. I've had things where I've read messages apparently I haven't even noticed that I've read because I happen to touch
You monster.
The things, though, about letters that you're describing that you love, you can't replicate in Women of Letters. You can't replicate the delay and the waiting and and all of that. So what was it that made you cotton on to the idea that a letter would be a magical performance event?
Well, I think because Marika and I are both writers ourselves, and we've talked about this a lot, we always think about what would happen if someone invited us to participate in something like this. We both thought that if, you know, you were asked to stand up and share a personal essay or a humorous story, we'd probably be a little bit more reluctant to agree. But a letter seems quite innocent and quite easy. Like, you could just dash it off in, you know, an afternoon. It won't take that much time. Of course, people in. I think so, yeah. And it's just got...
But the idea of reading a letter aloud, but that's frightening.
There's this quite neat trick, we think. We didn't ever expect people to be as honest and open and filthy and funny as they are at these shows, because they do know that they're going to read them in front of 400 people, of course. But just that act of sitting down and writing Dear Someone, it kind of almost lulls you into this sense of security that only one person is going to read that letter. And now maybe people are just trying to best each other. They've seen
the intimacy of it. Yeah, I think that the letter writing process itself is intimate and it's not a performance piece. And Mary Custis did our last show in Melbourne in November, our last show for the year. And one of the questions from the audience in the second half was, you know, did you practice your piece? Because her piece was quite emotional and strong and sometimes people have to practice over it. And she said, this wasn't a performance to me. I wanted to just speak from the heart and share a story, because she's an actor and a comedian. She knows how to perform. But for her, it was just a genuine yarn spin, I suppose. So she didn't want it to be a polished performance piece. And I think it did feel like something she just sat down and spoken from the heart and then got up and read.
Now, it began as Women of Letters.
Yes.
And then men were invited to come into the tent at some point, but that was quite a bit down the track.
It was actually only 6 months in.
Oh, really? Was it that soon?
Yeah, we moved venues and we didn't know if people would follow us, so we wanted to pack the room out with 10 guests and invited 10 men. We originally thought about having them do that in drag, actually, but it was an idea that didn't last
very long. Lucky for you, because you've done it, Wally. Yeah.
Was that the first one, the one that I did, or had you done Men of Letters before?
No, I think you maybe did the second or the third.
Yeah, right, because there were quite a lot of men at that time. It was quite a full bill.
It's because, it is still primarily a female-driven event. It is called Women of Letters. The monthly show in Melbourne is 5 women every month. The shows that we tour around Sydney and Perth and the one we did in New Zealand.
They're all the same format.
Yeah, they're all pretty much the same format. But we like to make things interesting for ourselves. Sometimes when we do festivals and there are great writers, we do co-ed shows, the People of Letters shows. In the new book, we've got the format of People of Letters where we get pairs of people try to letter to my other half.
So yes, either, which is in this book.
Yeah, collaborators or, you know, husband and wife, or Rhys Muldoon did it with Cram, who wrote the music for his kids' records. Yeah. So, but the men one, we just thought, because we were so rarely do bloke shows, let's get 10 of them and they'll all do a letter to the woman who changed my life. And that format hasn't changed either. I mean,
so it's always that topic for men.
Yeah. Always.
So it's always still about women ultimately.
Yes.
So
yes.
What was the thinking there? Was this like a social activism project that you were embarking upon with that? Was it about women's voices not being given enough of a platform? What was the driver?
Well, originally it sort of came about because Marieke and I met at a writers' festival in Newcastle, the National Young Writers' Festival, and there were all these women on panels and doing events that we'd never heard of or seen before, and they were just so interesting and funny and smart. And we thought it was such a shame that, you know, you have to go to Newcastle once a year to see women like that, and then there should just be more platforms for people who's, you know, they're not dialer quotes and on the media all the time, but it doesn't mean that they don't have something interesting and important to say. And it's been really lovely for us. Like, we always made a point from the very first show, the big names that'll get people in because they, you know, they want to see Judith Lucy or Miff Warhurst. But then all the audience end up leaving saying, like, what was the name of that redheaded girl again? I really loved her. And having not heard of them before, but falling in love with them. So we still do that.
Every show we make sure there's at least one. We call them the dark horse. We make sure that there's someone that a wider audience probably wouldn't know, whether they be, you know, an indie musician or a first-time author or a performance poet, in with the big names, and that makes the show so fun to curate. You know, we'll go, okay, we've got this A-list actress, so we don't need any more of those. Let's get a comedian. Do we want to, you know, and they're really fun, but some people got publishing deals from our shows. Wow. And
Molly Katz turned one of her earlier letters into a one-woman play.
That doesn't surprise me at all, though.
No.
Molly Katz, I think, just turns every conversation she has.
There was a quite famous Australian comedian who spoke at a show about her struggles with mental health, and there was an SBS producer in the audience who turned it into something on the feed. You know, she was really happy to share that story, and it was, you know, we never record the shows, and that's something we're really proud of. Yep. We don't record it, we don't podcast it, we don't video it, and this is an era where people take photos of their food. So for us to have created something that's quite ethereal and a safe space.
And authentic to the whole retro nature of what we're talking
but
about.
But it wasn't intentional. It
no,
was
no,
it was about, you know, there was no cynicism about it. We've taught
it's
ourselves
just a long
everything.
List of things that we hadn't thought about.
We've taught ourselves how to event manage, how to book tickets, how to do PAs, everything we've learned. That happened really organically. About four shows in, people started being very intimate, and maybe it is the letter writing part of it. People started contacting us saying, oh, we'd love to podcast it, or and we just instantly organically felt quite protective of it. And then the more performers and audiences in kind have responded to being a part of something that might never leave the room.
So many people say that they would never have participated or read the letter that they did if it had been filmed or recorded.
I completely believe that.
But, you know, in saying that, once they've done it, it's theirs to do what they, if they want to put it on the feed on SBS, they're able to. If they want to put it on their blog, if they want to read it on, you know, it's their letter.
It in a book.
Yeah, well, the book is open to anyone who's been in the show. And so the ones who aren't in the book are not because we've censored or we've,
by their
own
choice.
Absolutely.
That book, by the way, is called Between Us, Words of Wit and Wisdom from Women of Letters, and it's curated by Marieke Hardy and Michaela Maguire, who are my guests in the drawing room. I'm staggered at the people you get.
Oh, you and me both.
Does anyone say no?
Oh God.
So many.
Really?
Yes. You should see.
We've got this spreadsheet, and I thought I was going mental because I think it was booking a show in New York, and I'm like, I feel like we've asked everyone, and I counted it. We asked like 120 people to do one show and had locked in four.
That's in New York?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But it does happen here as well.
But you're trying to break a new frontier here.
But every year, Men of Letters, I mean, we've got, you know, Paul Keating said no to us a few times, Nick Cave, Malcolm Turnbull won't say yes.
Yeah. Or just timing. Like this year I got this great round of emails back. Like Tony Jones was like, oh, I'm working on my novel, and David Stratton was like, I'll be away, I'm in Venice at the moment, say hey to Marieke from Venice.
Oh, I didn't know David Stratton said to say hey.
He did.
I'm so excited.
You didn't pass that on.
I did.
But the thing is, the more that people said yes as we first started doing the shows, like someone like Ita Buttrose, we never thought we would have got. And when she said yes, it does give you confidence to go, bugger it, who else are we asking?
It also means you've got a very good approach email. Where you can say, these are the people who've spoken in the past.
It does help, but in America we had to start from scratch because, you know, as much as we all love Helen Garner and Ita Buttrose and Maxine McHugh, those names amazingly don't mean much in America to American agents.
Not as much as Marieke Hardy.
So we've had to start there all over again, you know, cap in hand, begging favours. But, you know, the last tour, Edie Falco and Martha Wainwright did it, and we're just unafraid to ask people now. We just you just Google Lady Gaga producer. Okay, dear Lady Gaga, you don't know me. My name is Marieke Hardy, and I, you know, you just think you never know.
Well, all
you just
do is
never know.
Put
when
you back where you started, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, they either ignore you or
that
they
happens
say
quite a lot.
Yeah, that happens a lot. But it's made us quite brave and fearless in terms of going. You just you never know who might say yes.
Well, congratulations on it. Thank you. It's now becoming an international behemeth, which is extraordinary. Yeah. And I should give you a chance just quickly to mention the charity.
Oh, Edgar's Mission is the charity that we raise money for in Australia. It's an animal rescue shelter in country Victoria. And she's just a powerhouse. She's an amazing woman.
They must be wrapped.
Yeah, we think we've raised about $500,000 for them since we started. So they
at
get
least a couple of barns.
They get all the proceeds from all the books and all the shows. Yeah. So, yeah.
This particular book, lots and lots of wonderful people in it, but there's one I want to focus on today, and it's very sad that we even have a reason for doing this, but the first letter in the book is written by Stella Young.
Yeah.
And it's a cracking letter, but it's a heartbreaking letter because of now we know what's happened. The topic she and others were given was to my 80-year-old self, and she just begins in a really heartbreaking way talking about the very fact that people assume she will never meet her 80-year-old self.
Yeah, I mean, I heard the really awful news last night, and I read that letter about three times, and I of course got very upset. I did find comfort in it, and not that it should be a selfish act reading her intimate portrayal of her life and her expectations of it, but she writes in there, she gives you the gift of what she feels about her mortality, and that she says, you know, maybe I'm here for a good time and not a long time. And, you know, it was actually like a really beautiful eulogy to herself as well.
There's pain in it though, because I got the sense reading a letter that she was, maybe the reason I say that is a kind of to be flippant about it, or there's a sense within her there was, I'm going to show the world effectively.
Yeah. She'd been told from when she was so young that, you know, she recites in the letter this time when she had a really minor operation on her elbow and a nurse told her, like, oh, you're 30, you've had a good innings. Mm. So that was something that she was acutely aware of her entire life.
It's just hard to reflect so soon after it happened, really, because it's not comforting. It's a massive loss and a very brutal loss and a very unfortunate one, because she's a warrior and a voice that we still need.
You can't help but feel that it'll power on somehow.
Well, it will, because she's done so much work, but she had so much more work to do. She was writing her memoir that we're never going to read, and I'm angry about that.
Yeah. Tell us, though, about the relationship with Women of Letters that you had, because it was more than just her contributing a letter that ultimately found its way into it.
Kicked our asses.
Yeah, she really
did. Well, she did that to everybody.
A justifiably hard time. Because Marika and I are writers, not event managers, we had never thought about the fact that the venue that we started out at wasn't wheelchair accessible. And Stella sent us an email and said, like, hey, you know, you guys are assholes. I really want to come to one of your shows. And, you know, it's not really fair that you're not making that possible. And so we were quite embarrassed because we had actually just never thought of it.
And also, we talked about having her on the stage before, going, we should get her to a show. And she's like, well, I'd love to, but I can't even get in the venue.
You know, giant marble staircase.
Yeah.
So we worked kind of with her in looking at different venues around Melbourne for a good few months, and we'd tell her how we were going and who we'd been talking to, and she gave us great suggestions of places to try and venues that she knew were particularly cooperative. And eventually we found the Regal Ballroom, who are accessible and just wonderful. And, you know, they put a ramp up to the stage every time that we have Stella involved. So we were able to move venues and got her to do the first show, which was when she read that letter to her 80-year-old self. But it was such a wake-up call for us just to be called out on being a bit lazy and a bit awful, really.
And in the way that only Stella can.
Yeah. And, yeah, it was in a great, charming, forthright, formidable fashion that made you go,
sort of,
God, we're idiots. And then you do it. And that, I mean, that's how you raise awareness. You're not a dick about it, but you're forthright about it. And that's what she was, you know. Yeah. And it is once the lens is opened, then everywhere you go, she makes you naturally kind of start thinking, is this an accessible, is there an accessible
toilet? Just
changed
the paradigm and the lens through which you're viewing the world. It's a very powerful letter to read, particularly in retrospect. But what did that letter mean for her, and what was it like in the room?
I did an interview with her nearly a week and a half ago talking about this. It was hard for her to read, and she obviously had to confront a lot of realities about her own life. But she spoke really beautifully about a disability activist whose name I cannot horribly remember.
Was that Harriet?
Harriet, and how much that had meant to her. This wonderful woman who was told that she would die young and then thought, well, if I'm going to die young, I may as well go to kindergarten, and if I'm going to die young, I may as well go to primary school, and, oh, I guess I'll go to university, and then became a lawyer and then realised that she'd sort of missed her chance to die young, that she was already 30. But that was a particularly powerful show, not only for Stella's contribution. Kate Kennedy read at that show and was writing to her 80-year-old self days after giving her mother's eulogy. Mm. So that was a very sad show in many ways, but also really joyful. We made it quite clear that it was the first show that we had moved to a wheelchair-accessible venue, and there was this great sort of sense of celebration in the audience, and everyone was completely behind the move.
Which I think sums up the contribution that Stella's made in so many ways. That hero of hers, by the way, Harriet McBride Johnson, who she describes as one of my most beloved Crip heroes, which is so Stella Vale. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Sorry to have to end on such a somber note, but I think it's absolutely appropriate in the circumstances. The book is Between Us, Words of Wit and Wisdom from Women of Letters. It's curated by my guests in the drawing room, Marie Carty and Michaela Maguire. We're at an end now. We'll be back at 6 o'clock tomorrow. See you then.